So we have about 10 minutes for a group discussion. Then we're going to have a full 15-minute break. While we set up the stage, we'll be transitioning to a performance, which is not to say that we haven't already had performances, right? We want to think of performance, too, as a hybrid category. One of the interesting things that seems to me across the three presentations we just heard is the importance in each presentation of the disruptive queer body or disruptive queer bodies. We saw the disruption caused by Sylvia and Cece in his presentation, the disruption that intersex presents to set ways of thinking about male and female as the two forms in which bodies may appear, a disruption so profound that medical intervention is required to make doctors feel comfortable, make parents feel comfortable. The comfort of infants and the adults they are to grow into seems to be the last thing on the table. And then we see the disruption of the queer signet rings. Sorry, couldn't avoid the pun. The queer signet rings of Sean Dorsey's dance. But I was really interested in the way in which discomfort, and maybe I'm very much thinking about issues of discomfort. I'm benefiting from long conversations also with Karen Shimakawa, who's been thinking about discomfort in her work. But I was really interested in the way in which discomfort appeared in each of your presentations. And again, so whose feeling of difference is at stake in so much of this? And I think it was also there, as Minister, in your presentation, thinking about you spoke about the idea of personal gender, and it seems to me that in some sense, at one level, there's no such thing as personal gender, because you also talked about the desire for mirroring or recognition. So in fact, one wants, ultimately, I suppose, for someone else to sort of recognize that personal gender might be yours but can be shareable. So there's something about a certain kind of breaking through discomfort that can't see difference, right? Because it's about what does it mean to see difference and not require, and actually, you don't have to get it, right? What? Well, you don't have to get difference. Right, in the sense of what if you actually encounter difference and can't assimilate it? But I just sort of some thinking about some quite fascinating crossings across these panels. But let me open it up to the audience for questions and conversation. Again, we've got a nice 10 minutes. Again, we have a microphone circulating. Please. That'd be great.
I wonder if you guys would like to ask each other those questions to one another.
Turning the tables. Yes. Oh, we also have.
I have a lot of questions, but we'll at the dinner.
And we do have a question from the audience. So, thank you for going.
I was
first.
Wondering what the current legal and political status of these intersexual people is. By bizarre coincidence, in a room with the head of pediatrics at Cornell 6 months ago, talking about these growth charts that were pink and blue, and everything, when you press a button to write an order, you get a picture of someone like from a bathroom on an airliner, you know, pink and blue with skirts and not. And I said, what do you do? Just in passing, I said, how do you accommodate ambiguously gendered people? And the answer was, we don't. Mm-hmm. And they have to be assigned, and these were words that came out of her mouth, they have to be assigned a gender for the rest of their lives before we let them out of the hospital, which I did said okay. I didn't know what else to say. But what's up?
Well, what?
I think you just pressed it.
Yeah, it's like, you know, boy, that was just too easy. But what's up is a whole other thing. But I will say this, what's happening is that we are organizing and we are doing work to get the standards of care changed. We are doing everything we can to make it clear that if these experimental surgeries continue and they continue to fail as routinely as they do, that doctors will be at risk for medical malpractice. And as that changes, that's what changes people from doing what they were taught in school. So unfortunately, it's about money. The other thing is that the American Academy of Pediatrics put out what's called a consensus statement in 2006 that finally says that genital surgery on infants under 1 year old isn't the standard of care. It isn't what must be done, but it can be done. okay? And that they should consider before they actually take that course. Now, I'm fighting for that language to change mm-hmm. so that they must not.
And if we were to be in a position to choose another color for the gross tarts, what would it be?
Happily, I'm colorblind. And I can't tell pink from blue. But frankly, I think these colors are one of the most damaging things that happen when we categorize children. We give them a belief that they have an identity to live within for the rest of their lives. And so many of us who are born intersexed are assigned one sex, and later at puberty or sometime later in our life say, that doesn't fit for me. And I knew at puberty that I was never going to make it as a boy. There's just no chance. I'm never going to be able to make it as a boy. So making it as an intersex person, that fits. I know I'm intersexed. But trying to pretend that I'm a boy, fuck it. No way.
In the back? Yeah.
Speaking of standards of care, both Espen and Tiger, you mentioned depathologizing gender variants. I'm wondering what policy you would propose to replace that with that would both preserve and increase access to medical treatment for trans and intersex people in our current medical bureaucracy.
Can you repeat that?
I'm wondering to replace viewing pathologizing gender variants, what policy you would propose that would preserve and increase access to medical care for trans and intersex people.
Sure. You know, there are two diagnoses in the world that people fight for. That I know about. One is pregnancy, and the other is transsexualism. And to depathologize is not necessarily to take away diagnosis. So if you are pregnant, that is a ticket for medical technology to assist you if needed. And if you are trans in some way, that should be a ticket for medical technology to assist you in your path to where you want to go. And I don't think that's so very, very hard to do that. That we can address the medical society without being sick. And I'm advocating for that all the time. By being a therapist, I've been taught to treat those who are disturbed. And the ones who are disturbed are the people who are disturbed by us. So I treat them. I work with that. You know, that's why I'm here. And if you take that a little longer, any person of difference can address the medical system and say, "Well, I need." It's like going to the baker shop. I need some rye bread, and they say, "Okay." And you don't have to be sick.
I would add to that the. It's not as though diagnosis of transsexuality guarantees you access to any form of care, even if you are one of the minority
that
is adequately true. Even if you're one of the minority that is adequately covered by health insurance, right? That most employers have opt-out clauses for transsexuality, and most of them use them. So I think the question I would ask you is, what do we lose by depathologizing the category? It sounded as though there was something in there that you were interested in questioning, and I'm curious to hear what that might have been.
I completely agree that it shouldn't be viewed as a disorder. Mm-hmm. But I guess I'm thinking, so I'm transitioning under informed consent, mm-hmm. which is, for people to know, you just sign a document that you're aware of the risks. But this exists as kind of the other of the gatekeeping methods of standards of care mm-hmm. as like a kind of harm reduction strategy, the idea being that I would, you know, go purchase hormones in the black market or something otherwise. It's difficult for me to see informed consent becoming the norm, without it being placed in the same category as cosmetic surgery that we denigrate in the United States.
Can I? Yeah. One of the things that we talk about a lot, the Sylvia Vera Law Project, is GID diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And the difference between being pathologized and identifying with a diagnosis. Because a lot of people who seek services at the Sylvia Vera Law Project are currently incarcerated and strongly identify with a GID diagnosis. So there's a lot of conversation about ableist implications of saying, no, you don't actually have a diagnosis. What does it mean to say, no, you don't have a diagnosis, instead of, no, no one deserves to be pathologized? So that's one of the conversations that we're having. And how people leverage a GID diagnosis, which doesn't often work, for small amounts of healthcare that everyone deserves, consenting, if they consent to a form of healthcare, right? And the other conversation that we're having in the Sylvia Vera Law Project is charting the growth of neoliberalism with the movement of people who are queer and trans saying, no, I'm not crazy, right? So the DSM-3 in 1994, when it kicked off homosexuality, coincided with a few other things like the American Libraries Association not naming homosexuality as a like bizarre group of people. And it also coincided with the rise of gay people saying, actually, I'm normal. I deserve to be normal, just like you're normal. And it coincided with a movement shrinking who should be represented, right? So that's why Sylvia Vera wasn't allowed on stage, because it was increasingly matter of fact that people wanted to present a really normal way of appearing to straight mainstream society. So I think it's really important to kind of chart that history, right, of the rise of saying, I'm very normal, I'm not crazy, the ableist implications in that, the fact that people should be consenting to healthcare, right, and that, and thinking about coercion at birth, which I, you know, and coercion, you know, personally, I think that gender self-determination is very different than being assigned a birth by a doctor, right? Oh, that's yeah. not consent. That's coercion, and it happens to people in particular different ways in a range of violences. And I think the violences that we have to have a really particular nuanced conversation about, and not conflate trans with intersex, right? And trans, intersex, and gender nonconforming, because people face and navigate many different kinds of violences. But I think those three things are really important: the rise of normal, no, I'm not crazy, yes to gender self-determination, not coerced. Assigned gender, and it's really important for me to say, oh, you identify with the diagnosis. I'm not going to say, no, you don't have that, because that, to me, supports ableism.
So from the standpoint of how does intersex people want to be able to get care as intersex people, one of my favorite stories about this is a patient of mine who's an XX person, which is a female pattern for chromosomes, has a full penis, lived as a male all his life, but he has a kind of a difference inside of his body where the back end of the uterus becomes part of the bladder. So he bleeds through his bladder once a month, right? Now, this person is practically allergic to testosterone, but because he chooses to live as a male, it took me about a year to find a physician who would give him estrogen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's just wrong, because once he was on estrogen, he said, I saved his life. He said, I saved his family's life. His wife and his children still send me cards every year thanking me for having cured their dad. Okay? So there's a problem with how it is that we want to divide things on the basis of not just gender and sexuality, but also on the basis of if you're male, you get testosterone, if you're female, you get estrogen, and that's it. For intersex people, that's not the way it is. And because, as he so well said, in the medical society, we don't exist. We've already been eliminated. It's very hard for intersex care to be recognized.
I think we have a question here. Okay, so we've got time for two more.
Yeah, just want to post a question of what the diagnosis is. Is the diagnosis the absence or presence of a certain body part or a certain hormone? Or is the diagnosis your identity is wrong? And I think the latter is what we have to fight against, and the first is what we have to fight for.
You know, I love words, and words have really been very present in this evening. And diagnose means to look through windows of knowledge. That's what it means. So back to you. If the medical society can see trans through the windows of knowledge, there should be not much to fear. Because then they will also see the pain that some people have, pain that will be corrected if they get the right treatment or the treatment they want, which is right for them. So diagnose does not equal pathology. It equals knowledge. So still, we have to treat the disturbed with more knowledge.
I just wanted to add a quick thing. Someone who is really anti-GID diagnosis was Janice Raymond, right? And so in 1980, she wrote the report on medical and social aspects of transsexual surgery for the National Center of Reproductive Technologies, which was funded heavily by the Department of Health and Human Services to really talk and think about should trans people have access to surgeries in the U.S. And she talked about how trans people really were conforming to gender stereotypes, and therefore we're recreating gender stereotypes. So therefore, the medical model should be smashed, that trans people should, rather than access care that they think they need, should be supported to challenge their internalized notions of what gender roles are and internalized thoughts of sexism. So I think that that conversation, that discourse, weighs so heavily on conversations about diagnosis, pathologization, which is a word I have a hard time saying,
yes.
To be pathologized and access to medical care through a lens of consent.
We have time for one last question.
It may be the wrong kind of question, but I think that we also need to question the word normality,
mm-hmm.
Because we have, you thought about, this is a difficult word, exoticizing. I think that is to fantasize some abilities on another group and make them interesting or make them powerful or attractive or dangerous or whatever, but they're all fantasies. And I think that we have a lot of fantasies about the others who are normal. And I've been working as a psychologist for 30 years, and I think I still haven't met one single person who doesn't feel differently, but also fantasize about the others, the normality as something that I have to adapt to. That wasn't the question, wasn't it?
That's great. That's a great question.
I'm just thinking that one of the interesting dimensions that on the one hand, yes, everyone feels different. On the other hand, the ways some subjects get the liberty of feeling different and not being punished for it, right? That is the privilege of being normal, so that your variation actually is still within the range of the normal. And others then, their difference becomes representative of an alterity that must be banished, must be overcome, must be eradicated in some way. Even the most sort of red-blooded, heterosexual, hot, macho, white Christian man in America still probably feels inadequate in some way, but he gets to be senator. He gets to be a senator, right? I mean, because certain forms of feeling inadequate get rewarded, right? Other forms get punished.
I would love for all of you for 2 seconds to look at the person who's sitting beside you. Can you do that? You find someone beside you.
You can have a triad, don't
you? Okay.
Just step back a little bit.
Can you understand how it is to be the person you just looked at? No. But is the abnormal people are the only people who's asked, how is it to be you? We could ask anybody that question, because we cannot know. And I think that's also a basic thing to learn, that it is impossible to know how it is to be another person. But it is possible to ask, how are you? And who are you?
That's a really lovely way to close. Stay tuned. We're taking about a 10-minute break, doing full-on setup. Get your jazz hands ready, because there's music coming your way by Malik Gaines.